You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, episode 420. Yeah, drug references, edginess. Hey, this is Adam White. I'm recording from my basement. Welcome to the Punk News Podcast, episode 420. Joining me on tonight's show, there's only one of us. Well, I mean, aside from me. And that's Mr. John Gentile. Hey, John.
Wasted away again in Margaritaville, searching for my lost shaker of salt.
That's one of those songs that I only know the lyrics to because of the brief moment on The Simpsons when I think, like, Barney sang that in the bar. I don't understand how my kids are going to understand things without having, like, The Simpsons to culturally filter it through for them. or just to expose it to them, right? Like, my family, for better or worse, were not parrot heads, so I don't know how I would know, you know, two lines of Margaritaville if not for The Simpsons. John, it feels like forever since we've done one of these.
It has been forever, Adam. It's been at least a week or two, we're two old pals that meet up at the pub every week to talk the news, to talk what's happening, and we didn't do it last week because it was a Misfits week, and the audience was like, "No, we can't handle any more podcasts. Please, no more podcasts, sir. Please."
Actually, that was a serendipitous thing that happened in that we were going to record, and then, I don't know, I was tired or mad or something, and I'm like, I don't want to record right now. So we have too many podcasts. We'll do it next week. And then right after that, like, someone tweeted us, and they were like 4 hours of Misfit podcasts. Fuck. So it's like, okay. See, there's reasons. There's reasons we back off.
I'm glad that we didn't miss a week, and we haven't missed a week in, what, 400 and, well, actually probably like 435 episodes, because we've got a lot of non-numbered episodes, so we haven't missed a week ever in like 435 episodes, which is pretty cool. But also, I was quite, let's just talk about this now. I mean, so it was Misfits week, a while ago, by the time you'll hear this, but it was Misfits week of Punk News. Tom Tromm and I did two episodes of the podcast. We did Misfits week, Misfits podcast, and Danzig podcast, and they were both 2 hours long, but it felt like to me that, like, we didn't even, and not to pat ourselves on the back, but as with regular Punk News podcast too, like, Punk News Podcast records about an hour, hour and a half. The Misfits Podcast, 2 hours each. It feels like we haven't even gotten to half the stuff we want to get to, which I think is good. However, Adam, as someone, I think, Adam, I believe you are a fan of the Misfits, at least generally, correct?
Yeah, generally is sort of like a better word for it. Like, the Misfits were not one of my like, canonical punk bands when I was growing up. Like I was a Clash person, I was a Sex Pistols person, I was a Ramones person, and that was my trinity. And like, from there I branched out into things like the Buzzcocks and the Undertones and stuff like that, Dead Boys and whatever else. But Misfits, actually, I came back around to a lot later than I was into any of those other bands. And I think it was because when I was young, while I was discovering all these young punk bands, the Misfits were already a cultural presence to me in that I was aware of the merchandising of the Misfits. Like before I knew about like a lot of like these classic punk bands, you know, I knew there were stores in the mall where, you know, people could go and buy, you know, like a shirt with the Misfits skull on it. And it never registered to me as something I needed to go check out. Like, it fell into this same general, I don't know, like general, like probably the same blinders that I looked at a lot of metal with at the time, where I was just like, yeah, okay. Like, I understand that is some form of loud music, but it's not on the track that I'm on. And then like a lot later, I was like, oh, I get it. This is actually one of the foundational, you know, bands in this thing that I'm into. I should probably clue in a little bit. But because of that, my Misfits knowledge is like, I'm like an appreciator, but I have no depth. So I very carefully skated around being the one on those podcasts trying to sound smart.
Actually, I'm going to throw us off track immediately, and then we'll come back to the discussion that I wanted to have.
We have no track, John.
We're going where there are no roads. What I will say is whenever we do a podcast special, be it Black Flag or whatever, Adam, you always espouse, well, maybe I won't be on because I'm not a Black Flag expert or a Ramones expert. I'm always surprised that you feel as though perhaps intimidated about what we're going to cover on these podcasts. Unless I'm reading you wrong, but you often somewhat seem reticent to, I guess, really dive into the Band Week podcast. Am I wrong?
I try not to like swing what is a very classy way to say like big knowledge dick, because that's what I was going to say. I'm trying not to swing that around because like I don't. Because I don't feel that like I am an expert on a lot of those things. Like I feel that like I could sit down and talk about the Clash for a long time. I could sit around and have, you know, the John Lydon discussion for a long time, the Ramones discussion. But I don't know. Like I just assume that there is someone more qualified in our universe than me. And, you know, I don't want to be there just for the sake of my own ego.
But there's always someone more qualified on almost anything. You know what I mean? It's hard to be the best at anything in the world because being the absolute best is subjective. Once you get past a certain point, who's better is purely subjective. So Adam, what, considering your way to express yourself, your way of considering things, your at least general knowledge of the bands, how do you know that you're not at least adequate or if not an optimal choice for participating in almost any band discussion?
Well, see, this actually fits into a whole underlying psychosis of Adam that that I was thinking about the other day.
I'm glad we're getting into this, Adam.
Continue. No, it's important, right? Where, because I'm trying to remember why this came up. Oh, it's because we were chipping at each other in the back channels of Punk News about something that came up that was pretty snarky about the Punk News universe.
Oh, yeah,
my default reaction to anything like that is to be like, well, you know, yeah, we suck. What are you going to do?
And my default was, we're the best. Let's kill them.
Right. And then, but then I was thinking about that and I'm like, why is my default on everything to always like defer to like, you know, yeah, we should probably just like fall on our own suckiness here and not make a big deal about it. Right. And I realized that there's a whole part of my brain that lives in this combative world where it's trying to push back against anything that I perceive as entitlement, right? And even things that I'm totally should be okay with. And this is deep, John. We're going to really get fucking off Punk News here. But like this goes like right back to the foundational, like the origin stories of what makes Adam White tick. You want me to do this?
Yeah, let's do it. I'll get off the couch and I'll put on the jacket with this elbow patches and the pipe.
Oh, because there's so much wrapped up in this, right? So, okay. So I grow up, I am in a Canadian border town and I grow up in a Italian Catholic household. So I end up pushing back against two things in very different ways, but they both kind of get me to the same conclusions. So first of all, when I was a kid and we used to like go to the parks and you know, play and run around in the woods and all that stuff, the parks that I was going to run around in were always battleground parks. they were parks where the War of 1812 was fought. Like the park we always used to go to as a kid was a place called Queenston Heights, which is right on the Niagara River. There's literally cannons there. There are, you know, monuments to the various British generals, you know, all over the place, big and small, who fought back the Americans. So I was really acutely aware, really young, of the fact that like, oh, like the Americans were invading us and we had to fight the Americans, right? And then way younger than I think, you know, anyone normally should be, I latched on to the fact that like, oh, not only that, but there was this whole manifest destiny concept that was sort of fueling that. And part of like the hubris of the American experiment here was that, you know, this exceptionalism, that they were not only right in what they were doing, but that like they were so right that they could and should start to lord that rightness over the rest of the world. So as a young lad, I was like, oh hey, fuck that, right? So I was very anti that, like that idea of like exceptionalism, that idea of taking wherever you are in your culture and deciding like oh, that's the thing, right? So there was that aspect of it, but then there was also this, like, I was being raised in this Italian Catholic, you know, realm, and probably like early high school, because like I was pretty good at like being a Catholic kid. Like I was never an altar boy or anything like that, but I was attentive and I went to all the rituals and things like that. And I would go to a church and pray, because like I was supposed to pray. Like I wasn't just like, you know, oh, I'm gonna do this because I'm expected to do it. Like I believed that was all stuff that worked. But at the time where I started to turn against that, which was like coincidentally when I started getting into music and learning about things like Bad Religion, to, you know, make a cliche. But part of what really started to drive me against that was I started to take like comparative religion classes and things like that, and realized that like, oh no, there's all sorts of people all over the place. And it's not, you know, you do not happen to just be born into the, you know, into the one way to get into heaven. Like you actually have this accident of birth, and that's where you happen to be in this or that culture, but everyone else is in their own cultures and they have their own things. And who's to say that your shit is, you know, any more right or any more important than the rest of their shit? And part of me like getting out of like the religious indoctrinization was to like really internalize this, like this sense of, you know, you don't know anything about anything and you really shouldn't try to lord that around stuff. Right. So I have these two things that have manifested in my head where it's like, A, you know, you should stop being so, what's the word for this?
Cultural supremacy, but they don't call it that. Nepotism?
No, there was cultural relativism. I don't know what I'm trying to say here. In any case, I should stop looking at everything through this, you know, basically it was basically about privilege, but we didn't call it that at the time, right? Like I should stop looking at everything out of this like white Christian male Western lens and assuming that because I happen to be born into that, you know, cascading set of accidents, that I, you know, that I know anything special that anyone else doesn't know. And at the same point, I was very acutely of like against whenever I saw, you know, historic America sort of excising that same instinct. So I feel like a lot of that's really fucked me up and has made it really hard for me to approach anything with too much of a sense of ego about it, even when like you should have some healthy ego about it. I don't want to talk too much about what's it called, like imposter syndrome, because I feel that like the internet has really ruined that for everyone. There's, like I said, like a few terms that, like, I don't know, maybe this is like if you're in tech, but there's a few terms that are like pop psychology terms that show up constantly amongst people that are in, at the very least, in like this like entrepreneurial tech realm that I happen to like be in my day job. And people are always fucking talking about, you know, oh, my, you know, I don't feel like I'm good enough. I don't feel like I'm good enough, right? Imposter syndrome. But then people are always also talking about, and this has nothing to do with the thing, it just annoys me, is introversion. Oh, I'm so I'm introverted. I'm introverted. Here's a list. Here's 10 things that introverts only know. And I'm like, why is the internet all about introverts? I don't understand. But that really has nothing to do with this point. Anyways, though, I remember at one point when I learned to public speak, I had to almost put on ego, a costume. Okay, I'm going to walk into the room and I'm going to I'm going to own that room. I'm going to puff out my chest and really sound like I know what I'm talking about. And then I would do that. And I'm like, oh, wow, that was really fun. But it was always costume, right? It's like, that's not how I naturally approach things. I naturally approach things. And I think a very, very, very punk appropriate, I sneer my way into the room and I want to go hide in the corner and die kind of thing. But the ego thing, I could totally do, but it was always it was an affectation that I was consciously putting on. So whenever it comes to one of these things where it's punk news is being slandered, what do we do? Are we gonna stand up for ourselves? I'm like, no, if you really think about it, we should stop, we should stop thinking that we actually are any good. We should just capitulate to the fact that we probably suck. And at the same point, it's like, hey, we're gonna do a podcast about, Vic Goddard and the Subway Sect. Who's going to be on that? And I'm going to be like, oh, I don't want to be on that. I don't want to pretend I know anything about Vic Goddard and the Subway Sect. But yeah, so I don't know. Does that make any sense? Is that accurate self-psychologizing?
Fair enough. Which Adam was on stage at Summer Soiree 1 in the top hat yelling at the crowd to get hyped? Which Adam was?
Oh, that's totally fucking Adam that has public speaking training, because I love, that's the weird thing too, and I guess maybe it's a perversion that I have or something like that. Unlike a lot of people, I love public speaking. I love being on a stage. If there were 400 people in a room, and whatever they were all there to see wasn't going to show up, and they're like, oh God, someone get on the mic and talk to these 400 people, I would do it in a heartbeat. And it's partly because I just relish the attention, but I think it's just because again, I'm so self-wired myself to not be that way, it's like a dirty pleasure to be able to get on stage and to do that kind of thing, I guess. I don't know. In any case, John,
well, in all things, Adam,
I didn't talk about the Misfits on your podcast.
So the point is this: is I thought Misfits Weeks came out, I would say, good.
Did you expect me to go into Manifest Destiny as one of my reasons why I wasn't on the Misfits podcast?
You see, I wasn't on the Misfits podcast because of the War of 1812, John. You see,
that was essentially it, man.
So anyways, I thought Misfits Week was very good. I thought the reviews written by the crew was fantastic. I thought the podcasts were very good. I thought the features were pretty good. I wish we had a little bit more, I guess, in-depth, thorough features. I think Jello Week was the best week that we've done. I would give Jello Week an A+. I'd give Misfits Week about a B+, I'd say. I wish the features were a little bit more in-depth. They were good, maybe not amazing, I did feel as though that Misfits Week got a little bit more of a muted reception than Ian Week, than Clash Week, than Ramones Week, and actually Black Flag Week and Jello Week. Adam, did you feel though the reception of Misfits Week was somewhat muted, or is that just me because they're one of my favorite bands, so I was expecting the internet to explode when we covered Misfits Week?
I mean, I actually thought that the reaction that I saw to it seemed strangely positive, muted in a way that people weren't as mad at us as they tend to be. What really struck me was, so you posted an article at the end of that week where you collected, all the links to all the features, a links to all the reviews that went up, all the stuff. And in that article, you asked, okay, what do we do for the next week? What should we do? And instead of, 25 comments of people being like, fuck you, John. every comment is someone making a suggestion. And there's a bunch of them. So, if the reaction to us doing one of these, band theme weeks was, fuck you, John, then that would be the reaction. But it wasn't this time. at least on that particular article. So that's all right. I mean, if muted means people aren't shouting at us irrationally, then I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I don't know how to, because we went with Jell-O Week, they're like, John, you just want to suck Jell-O's dick. You know what I mean? It's like, no, you know, and with this one, we didn't quite get the hate, you know, so I don't know how to read that. And what band should we do? I'd love to do Crass next or The Damned. I just don't think the current staff has the interest that maybe you and I have in Crass and The Damned to be able to carry the weight of a full week for those bands. Who do you think we should do next, considering our current staff's talents and interests? Men at Work Week? All three albums?
Men at Work, oh God, people, everyone, it's funny because I'm looking through the suggestions that people have here. And the one, this was Ricky's suggestion, and I guess it's a sensible one, but it doesn't seem too ambitious to me, would be like, you know, All in the Descendants. And, you know, you could, I mean, I would totally dig reading someone's essay about the philosophy of All, because I find that the most, that is to me my favorite part of the whole Descendants universe is just this like this life creed of All that they came up with. But I feel like picking a band that maybe people are not too knowledgeable about, but then having, you know, requiring the staff to go deep dive on them might be kind of useful. And I was like, what was the one here that I thought was, yeah, I liked this suggestion a lot, would be the like Subhumans, Citizen Fish Family, right? Because you have tons of like little sub bands and projects that are all related to that, and to be able to draw a line between all those would be neat. But I can also see like,
and Dick Lucas does just, deserve, you know, it,
bands
honestly,
that have been around for a long time but just have not got the I don't know, have not got the punk news attention just because of the era that we're in. So like, I don't know, like SNFU, right? Like, go in and review all that stuff. That's not just me suggesting them because they're a Canadian band, right? I don't know. Husker Du?
The interest that we have to balance is the stand. Like, I'd love to do a Subhumans week because, honestly, I think, honestly, probably because he's still alive, Dick Lucas hasn't quite gotten the props of bands like Crass or Rudimentary Peni or Meebix. I mean, a lot of the guys are alive, but the bands are broken up. Where Subhumans were broken up, but they're back. And seeing the Subhumans is awesome, but it's not a rare thing. So I'd love to give Dick Lucas, you know, a week of attention, positive attention. I just don't know if the current staff has that interest. You know what I mean? So, I don't know. We'll see. Let's reach into the mailbag where we cover Misfits Week, and then we'll let it lie at that. One thing, though, Adam, I was highly disappointed. Almost no one talked about Christ the Conqueror. I wrote a review on Christ the Conqueror, and I thought it would like blow the internet up, and no one gave a shit, Adam.
John, you cannot expect people. This is, I mean, hold on a sec. We're entirely we entirely expect when we do things that are interesting, no one actually responds to them. But if, you know, the someone in the Lawrence Arms, you know, passed wind on a bus and we posted a story about that and we get like, you know, 30 comments. So what can you do, John? Do enough people know about Christ the Conqueror? Did you mention this on the Misfits podcast?
Well, we played them on the podcast, and I wrote a review, and I'm like, this is a perfect week to, because if you just bring up Christ the Conqueror for like no reason, it's like why? Christ the Conqueror, in case listeners don't know, is the thrash Christian metal band that Doyle and Jerry had after the Misfits in the late 80s and early 90s that actually, the band itself actually developed into the new Misfits when they brought Dr. Chud on drums, and no one cared at it. I'm like, look at this weird curio in the mid. And Christ the Conqueror is particularly interesting because it was recorded at a time when Danzig was really getting into the Satan thing, like, you know, like songs directly talking about how he thinks Satan is awesome. So Jerry Only, his former bandmate, comes back with an album that positions Jesus as a Viking that is awesome and kills people and sends them to hell, and No one, but me thought that was interesting. And the album is not good. Well, the actual thrash itself actually is decent 80s thrash. If you're a thrash guy, it's not mind-blowing. It's good. It's not great. And no one cared. Anyways, this is what people had to say about the Misfits Week. You can reach that podcast at punknews.org. Sonic Reducer says, I stopped listening to the podcast after the Black Flag one because of all the incorrect facts that were put forth in that one. Granted, and I'm an old dude that was a teenager when Black Flag put out their first record, so I had the knowledge that goes along with that instead of the podcast guys who were born after the band broke up. Not true, mind you. But the inaccuracies were pretty annoying. I was actually very surprised by that comment. I went back and listened to the Black Flag podcast, Adam, because that comment was driving me nuts. I have no idea what this person is talking about, because the Black Flag podcast is almost all opinion. The only facts we drop are, like, Keith was in the band to begin with. You know, they used to be called Panic. Ron Reyes was the second singer. Dez was the third. Henry was the fourth. Like, they recorded in 1982, but that was never released, and they eventually re-recorded all those songs on subsequent albums. That was very, as with all the band weeks, it was very fact-light and opinion-heavy, which is the point. I mean, if you want to research the band, you can, you know, read up on them. So that comment just really annoyed me, Adam, I gotta say. I don't know where that person was, I really don't know where that person was coming from.
Well, continue the letter.
Oh, that's the end of that letter. This one's from old punk, the lone punker. Oh. I'm sorry. This is with the lone punker.
Oh, that was where it ended? It's yeah. Like, oh, the letter was, I stopped listening to the podcast because you suck, and that was it?
That's it.
Oh, well, that's, I mean, he's not going to hear your reply.
I just don't know. I guess one thing is I'm so annoyed when people, and I shouldn't be, but on the Facebook or the site, when people post stuff that is just, like, demonstrably inaccurate. Like, we recently did an Ian MacKay article, or Ian MacKay article, and I said, Ian MacKay of Fugazi and Evens. And then on the Facebook, people were like, he was also in Minor Threat, you idiots. You didn't know he was in Minor Threat. You guys, I'm like, yeah, he was also in Embrace and Palehead. You know, like, I'm not going to list every single band he was in. I listed, like, the biggest one and the one he was in with his wife, who's also in that band. It's like, the fact that we didn't mention that he was in Minor Threat doesn't mean we didn't know he's in Minor Threat. It's almost like it's assumed. You know what I mean? It's like, it just drives me nuts at him.
Especially that.
I know. Anyway, this is from the Lone Punker. Hi, podcast. I really haven't paid attention to Effed Up over the years. I listened to to Hidden World several times and really enjoyed that record, but felt much less enthusiastic when checking out a couple of their Zodiac tracks. However, John's enthusiasm for the new album spread to me, and I've been eagerly anticipating the new album. Today, I finally had some time to check it out. Holy shit, what an awful album. It is so boring. Frankly, and without wanting to start a whole debate on what punk means, there is nothing that I would identify as punk on this album, musically, thematically, or otherwise. With its long-form songs, dependency on fancy studio production, and psychedelic lyrical themes, I consider Dose Your Dreams to be more akin to the pretentious arena rock that the first wave of punk was a reaction against. Additionally, the album's mix just sounds awful. I spent the first 15 minutes messing with the EQ on my stereo trying to make it sound right, but there's just no fixing it. The drums sound terrible. I'm absolutely amazed that John and Adam like this record, particularly John, who has repeatedly identified Rancid 5 as the ideal album. Dose Your Dreams couldn't be more ideologically or sonically opposed to Rancid 5. There is so much interesting new music out there. Why waste your time with this bland, pretentious, egotistical band, which obviously ran out of ideas a decade ago. I wanted to write in to share the opinion, as everyone has either cast worships on them or has no opinion whatsoever. After hearing Dose Your Dreams, I wouldn't even go see this band if I had free tickets from the Lone Punker.
It's strange to me to, I mean, I realize that those opinions are out there, but I guess I don't encounter them too much. But I read, what was the other day, is there, I saw someone that had a blog that was just reviewing, it was like a hardcore blog, and they were rifling through a bunch of, you know, it was a, like 8 or 10 capsule reviews all in a row of, you know, here's the hardcore records this month that you should go listen to, kind of thing. And in the list of stuff that he was doing, he reviewed that fucked up side project, the two song EP that's Jenny's hardcore,
Jellicoe and Woodbury,
right? He reviewed that, and he reviewed the Razor Voice Joyce comp that they put out, and, you know, was a fan of both of them, but, like, very purposefully, like, and intention, like, very intentionally, you know, made little to no mention of Dose Your Dreams in a way that was very, like, snidely dismissive of it. And I mean, I get that, I suppose, that like if your world is, you know, you live in the hardcore world most of the times, I can understand how the stylistic choices that the band's making don't fit with your worldview. And it might not be something you're interested in. And this guy didn't seem like he hated it, but it was like I'm not going to mention those things because those aren't, you know, I don't talk about that kind of music. I talk about hardcore. And my perspective on things lately has been, and by lately I mean like in the past 10 years, I guess, but I've been coming at punk and everything else from such like a pluralistic middle, where the thing that bores me the most these days are like four dudes with guitars, like the traditional kind of, like, you know, we got two guitars and a bass and a drum, and you know, we're all a bunch of white dudes and we're gonna sing songs about, you know,
being
white dudes, right? It takes a lot these days for a band that is just like that traditional, you know, band makeup to interest me much. And it's not like that's not a comment that I'm not trying to virtue signal there. It's not like, oh, I'm more woke because I listen to bands with women in them or anything like that. It's just that, like, I find those bands boring, and it takes a lot for me to click into a band that is just doing straight, you know, 90s style, again, like skate punk, for lack of a better term, then like it's an uphill battle for me to be able to really listen to one of those and enjoy it, at least on record. I can go see bands live and this never really clicks in, it never bothers me, but like recorded, I just don't get it. I mean, I don't want to shit talk anyone here, but like, so like one of the labels that kind of keeps coming up in my universe is a label called Thousand Islands. That's a label out of Montreal.
Good Salad Dressing. They put out a good Salad Dressing.
Also a good Salad Dressing. But like Thousand Island Records puts out tons of material, and it's all in it's all in like the 90s Epiphat like universe of sounds. And I come across it a lot because, like, well, they're a Canadian label, and I do that Canadian music newsletter. So I try to keep abreast of what they're putting out. But like, none of it clicks for me. And it's not a quality comment on those bands or anything like that. It's just not where my head's at to just go listen to you know, bands do that kind of thing at this point. So for me, from my world, like, fucked up is like scratches the itch that I want to scratch perfectly, in that they're, you know, I'll disagree that there aren't things on that record that are punk, but you know, where they'll do things that come from the hardcore lineage, but then they'll do all this other kind of weird stuff as well. And I'm taking it sort of all in together and going like, yeah, this has like the kind of like weird adventurous variety that I want out of the bands that I'm trying to listen to these days. Whereas a lot of like straight conventional punk and hardcore, I'm just like, eh, like I'm not, it, you know, again, like live, I'm totally into it, but just recorded, you know, I've heard them too much. At least I've heard them too much, or there's too much stuff that I think still holds up that is from history that I can go listen to. And yeah, so I don't know. That's my perspective on that. Like how do you counter that, John? What's your?
I kind of, Lone Punk has written a couple of times, and I respect him and I like him, but I definitely disagree with his take entirely. I don't think I said Rancid 5 is the ideal punk record. I think I said Rancid 5 is an amazing punk record, and it's a great comeback record. That being said,
Rancid 5 is the record that most bands should go try to record.
Right. But I would say Rancid 5 is not the only punk record. And in fact, I would argue that there's lots of way different punk records that are not like Rancid 5 that are equally as good and even way better. I mean, London Calling is not like Rancid 5 at all. London Calling is better than Rancid 5, even though Rancid 5 is excellent, you know. Rudimentary Penalized Cacophony is not like Rancid 5, and it's better than Rancid 5, but Rancid 5 is amazing. So just because one punk record has a great sound and is great doesn't mean the other punk records have to sound like it at all. I would actually say you should probably try to sound different. My argument with Rancid 5 is if you're a band that's lost and doesn't know what to do, then do Rancid 5 because it works great. Whereas I would say Effed Up is in the complete opposite side. I would say for Glass Boys, maybe they should have done a Rancid 5. This new record, I think it sounds like they're exploding with ideas, and I think that bear witness with the five or six spin-off records that are coming from this album alone. There's the 12-inch, which is not Scarlet Begonias, Jonah Falco's synth pop.
Jade Hairpin.
What did I say? Scarlet Begonias.
Scarlet Begonias. Jesus Christ.
There's that one. There's Jellicoe and Woodbury. There's the mixtape. There's the Raise Your Voice Joyce comp, and I think I'm forgetting one. But the point being is, it sounds to me that Effed Up is exploding with ideas, and I love the Zodiacs because they are so weird and different. And for me, with punk rock, the more weird and different it is right now, the more I'm into it. And that's to kind of echo Adam's statement, and then we'll play a song after this. But to echo Adam's statement is, I've this past year I've listened to a lot of punk and a lot of P-U-N-K punk. And honestly, like I'm kind of worried that I don't want to burn out on it because for whatever reason, I've been going to more record conventions or record convention type things than usual. And there's two or three sellers that I'd see at all of them, and they sell all these really cool CDs for $3 to $5 each. It'll be like, Vice Squad's first two albums, or the Vibrators' first two albums, or the entire discography of Menace, you know. And all those bands are good. But you listen to them and you're like, yeah, this is good. But they all kind of sound the same. There really kind of is a big differentiation between the first-tier punk bands and the second. The first-tier punk bands kind of all sound way different. You know, Sex Pistols don't sound like Clash, don't sound like Crass, don't sound like Amoebix, don't sound like... They all kind of sound the same. But, you know, like Vice Squad, Menace, they're cool. Vibrators, they're all cool, but they all kind of sound the same. And honestly, right now, I'm just getting kind of bored of the standard, you know, punk sound. Actually, I'm getting bored of the standard punk sound. And what I want is the non-standard punk sound, a la the Screamers, a la Effed Up, anything weird, you know. That's what I'm into right now. And I think Effed Up is doing an amazing job at that. I kind of don't need to hear another band do... You know, Out Come the Wolves again. I've heard it. You know, and Out Come the Wolves is great. And Out Come the Wolves is really derivation of the first or third or second Clash album, depending on how you look at it. You know, so what I want right now is something different and challenging, not something that I've heard before. And that's not to say that, you know, I never want to hear straight up three chord punk. I do sometimes. Just write. I don't want to be the guy that's got every Oi record and he's collected every Oi record for 25 years and he's got every single Oi record. It doesn't matter if it's bad, good, mediocre. He's got them all. And then one day he's like, I think I hate Oi now. And he sells all his records. Adam White, you and I know a certain punk, former Punk News editor that was Mr. El Punko, and then he decided he hated punk and now it's all he listened to his mainstream hip hop. You know what I mean? I don't want to be that guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, a lot of the times too, and it's strange when you talk about like which area of the subgenre is interesting you at the moment, because everyone comes at it with all this weird baggage, and it's people's baggage isn't the same. And this is one of the things that I've really kind of clicked into, where like a lot of the times I'll go and I'll listen to something and I'll go like, oh, okay, like, you know. There's definitely like a lot of like what I consider to be like punk energy and vibe and just like approach into what I'm listening to. And then I'll see the genre it gets tagged with. And like, and a lot of the times these days, I'll see something being tagged as like, oh, it's art punk, right? And I don't quite know what art punk means. It seems kind of like it's code for, oh, there's a woman singing and I can't quite categorize it, right? But then I'll see those same bands sort of derided. Because they'll be like, oh, this is, and Fucked Up actually fits into this category with like, oh, this is punk, but it's like kind of, it's kind of punk that Pitchfork likes. And I'm like, I don't know what that's code for exactly. Because I remember people talking about like, say, like the Thermals or like Titus Andronicus, and like they'd be like, oh yeah, that's like punk for the Pitchfork crowd. And like, I've yet to really grasp what that means. Like, I like a lot of those bands, so maybe am I the Pitchfork crowd?
Well,
I don't
know.
I don't read Pitchfork. Is that should I be?
Jokes like, on that. Pitchfork doesn't like any punk anymore. So,
Yeah, I don't understand what that categorization is supposed to mean, and I have a feeling it's just like it's an easy way to take one of these bands that is, I think, like pushing against someone's, very well, like people will go and they'll build a little box for themselves and they'll say like I understand in this box what is punk and what isn't punk. And then when something comes that like puts one foot in there and one out of it, I feel like they feel slightly threatened. Like stop calling that punk. Just call it indie rock, and then I know that I can ignore it. But if you call it punk or some sort of something hyphen punk, then you're pulling me out of my cool box here. My box where I understand everything. And you're gonna start dragging me over here into this world, and suddenly I'm one of these guys on the internet that's, just talking about how artistically amazing, Carly Rae Jepsen is, right?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like people are threatened that they're gonna get like pulled into some sort of weird direction that they don't want to go in. And again, coming back to my unified theory of why my brain works the way it does, I don't want to assume too much about, that what I think at any given moment isn't necessarily the right way of thinking about it. So, I'm open to that.
Let's play a song. You want me to play a song, or you want to play a song?
I'll play a song just because the song I'm about to play is in my mind very, very clearly punk and won't we'll put everyone back at ease, I
Radio Havana by
guess.
Rancid.
No, so here you go. So this is probably like the Toronto hardcore band. So if the new Fucked Up record, like if you weren't quite sure what that means, and that's always held up for you as the, the band that is indicative of Toronto's hardcore scene, here's one that I think is that even the Fucked Up guys would probably go and laud for you as being the band. And actually, someone from this band appears on Dose Your Dreams. So the band is called Shit, S.H.I.T. I've had a ton of material come out over the last little while, all on EPs and digitally, and in all sorts of like dribs and drabs, and the early stuff, super super reverby, super 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 messy sounding. They cleaned it up a little bit, at least for the sake of the record this time, in that it's not completely washed in distortion to the same degree, but it's still pretty grimy. I've There's something that gives me a little bit of like a Poison Idea vibe from a lot of the stuff that this band does. But John, the one thing that I read in a recent review was someone said there's a rudimentary Peni feel to some of the Shit material. So here you go. So this is from the Shit record. It's called What Do You Stand For? Came out, I don't know, some point earlier this year on, I want to say Iron Lung was the record that released it, but it was the label, but I'm not sure off the top of my head. I'm going to play the song Destiny. So this is Destiny by Shit from Toronto.
Yeah.
John, we're back. It's like 40 minutes. We haven't talked about any of the things we're supposed to talk about.
Well, so we got to do some deep psychological analysis.
Number one, the specials. Yeah, well, that was my fault. All right, so we're starting to start with the specials here. So on February 1st, the specials, the Two-Tone Band, they're going to release a new album. It's going to be called Encore, and it is going to be their first recordings to include vocalist Terry Hall since the iconic Ghost Town single, which is honestly one of my favorite things in the world. So the album will also include the original guitarist Linville Golding and bassist Horace Panter, as well as current drummer Kendrick Rowe and guitarist Steve Craddock of the Ocean Color Scene. So in addition to the originals, the album's going to include a few covers. The covers on there, at least the ones that we know about, there's going to be the song Black-Skinned Blue-Eyed Boy by The Equals and the song Blam Blam Fever by The Valentines. So there's a new specials record coming, and it is going to, it's going to include, I guess, a few different originals, let's say, than some of their past modern day records. John, at what point did you clue in or clue out of the specials?
When I first started collecting records, which was before records got popular again, I actually bought the first specials record for $5 and I dug it, and then I sold it on eBay for like 12, which now I totally regret. So that's when I got into the specials. I've always had somewhat of a, I would say, uneasy relationship with the specials. Then I really do like the specials. I like all three albums. I think the first one and the third one are the best. I think the second one is kind of a rehash of the first, to tell you the truth, without quite the pop of the first. I think, unfortunately, the specials is one of these messy bands in that after they put out three classic albums, they didn't totally break up and they didn't stay together. They kind of like existed in different formations, and they put out a whole bunch of mediocre and weird releases. You know, the specials with this guy, the specials with that guy. Let's put out an album where we just re-record all our old songs for no reason. Let's put out some live albums where we play the same songs over and over and over. The specials are great. I think it's great that Terry Hall is back in the band, but of course the main guy, Jerry Dammers, is not in the band. He quote wrote all the big songs, except for a lot of special songs or covers that they were back in the day. I think covering Black Skin Blue Eyed Boys is great because, of course, The Equals, featuring Eddie Grant, who would go on to Electric Avenue, was probably the first black and white rock band in England, so it's a great selection. I think the title's painfully bland. I think you should go see the specials live when you can, because they're great live. I think it'll be an okay album. The problem the specials face is if they just put out a clone of the first album, which is probably what people think they want, it's not going to be as good as the first one. It'll be okay. But if they put out something radically different, then it's not going to be the specials. It's a totally different band. So they've got a very uphill battle. And honestly, I got into madness about six or eight months ago, and I gotta say, I mean, even though the specials were first, and even though the specials basically created the English ska scene, I just like madness better at them because they're kind of funnier. They have like every special song is like super serious, whereas madness has serious songs too. But I feel as though they approach it from a less dogmatic and more humanitarian angle, and I kind of just like madness better just because they're kind of funnier, and I feel as though the specials is very anchored to a certain time, where madness is a little bit more timeless.
I could get that, and I feel like the madness fits more into the into this quest that I think you're on of like revisiting and reappreciating the
hits of the 80s,
you know, all the derided 80s new wave bands, right? Like, you know, I know that you had a Men at Work reappreciation, which you sort of inflicted upon me, but then you're all into Flock of Seagulls. Oh, too, right?
Flock of Seagulls' first record is amazing. People really do not appreciate Flock of Seagulls' first record. Flock of Seagulls, Bow Wow Wow, Men at Work. I tried to get into one other band, but actually it turned out they were terrible. It was Depeche Mode. They are terrible. And I got one other band that was really bad, so I'm trying to see if I can remember who they were. Girls on Film, Duran Duran, terrible, terrible, Adam.
So I was, as a like as a proper two-tone, or sorry, as a proper third wave ska kid, the Specials were a foundational band, on the level of the Clash for me, before I hit the point where I realized, oh, my interest in ska is actually pretty shallow, but my interest in punk is going to go a lot deeper than that. And then I kind of veered off into that. But there was a point where I was like a young teen, and I'm like, I like punk, I like ska punk. I don't know which of those camps I'm really in. Maybe I'm just like a ska kid, and the punk thing is a, is a fun neighborhood yard to go play in, but it's not where I live, right? But no, it was the opposite actually. But so the first two Specials records are really super important to me. For some reason, the third, not so much. Probably for like really boring commercial reasons, which is that there was a while in when I was young when the first two were like Specials and More Specials were like readily available and like constant and like, they were either reissued right at the time or they were just like constantly in print, but it was a lot harder to find the third one there, without use of the internet, at least it was like in the studio, that one.
And that's one thing with the Specials, is it's so difficult to figure out which is a legitimate release and like which is like a real Specials release and which is one where they're just like, there's Specials, AKA, like it's hard to sort out which is like a canonical album, you know?
Yeah, so I mean it is difficult. Now, I think that the Ghost Town EP, like the single with the two other songs on it, like Why and Friday Night, Saturday Morning, it is one of those perfect releases. Like to me, that is just like front to back, just like a wonderful slate of music, like completely, encapsulating everything that was cool about two tone. Like it didn't, and I guess this is what you're talking about with regards to the seriousness of it, but just this weird undercurrent of like paranoia that played in a lot of that early Specials material. Which was almost like a lot of those early Specials songs was almost like it was like being in like a it was like could you could be in like a in an Orwell novel or like a spy film or something like that. There was so much about that early Specials stuff that was cool when a lot of like third wave ska just took the goofiness of two tone and amplified it. But man, like the Specials were so cool for a time. And I think partly because I liked that stuff so much, I didn't get into any of the, and like say, let's say anything that the Specials recorded post like 1987, because like at that point, like, you knew, like you knew they were either A, an old band that didn't have everyone that was still going, or worse, they were trying to capitalize on the fact that ska had come back into fashion, and I was just like, no, I don't want to go there, because there were other bands in that era that did the same kind of thing, or even from before that era that did that same kind of thing. Like, did you listen to any of, say, like the Skatalites stuff from the like from the late 90s?
Yeah,
Because they
honestly,
were releasing records.
with the Hellcat stuff, I did listen to. I basically listened to the stuff on the Hellcat comps, like Dave Hilliard, Slackers, some Skatalites, that kind of stuff. But I never really got, because honestly, I dug all the singles on those Hellcat comps, and then I got a couple of the albums. I'm like, oh wow, there's really not much more here than the singles, you know.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I'm interested to hear this one because I feel that my opinions on both early Specials and late Specials are they're pretty old at this point. So I'd be willing to take the new thing that's coming out with a fresh ear. But yeah, anyways, that's coming out. Speaking of old people, and I'm going to say speaking of old people for the next two stories. So speaking of old people, there's a new band, John. And this new band contains the aforementioned Ian MacKaye of Fugazi and the Evens and Minor Threat. John, do you know he's in Minor Threat?
He was? I didn't know. I
Minor
write for Punk
Threat,
News,
yeah.
and I didn't know that.
Minor Threat, John, straight edge, you know, Minor Threat. Anyways, so it's got Ema Kay in it. Amy Farina, who is also in The Evens and was in The Warmers. And Fugazi's Joe Lally. So they've formed a new band. The band does not, at least as of us recording this this thing, have a name yet. And they're planning to play their first show the Sunday after we record this podcast. So they're going to be playing a show benefiting Loaves and Fishes, which is a program run by the St. Stephen and Incarnation Church in the nation's capital in Washington, D.C., which benefits homeless people. So the show is going to be at the St. Stephen's Auditorium in Washington, D.C., which is not a detail you, the podcast listener, needs because it will already have happened at this point. But as of right now, this band has no name, but a lot of people are really fucking excited because it's at least half of Fugazi playing together. John, is this are you excited about this? Is this a thing that interests you?
I am excited about it. Surprisingly to me, in the Punk News Hovercraft office, I think I'm the only guy that likes The Evens. You don't like The Evens, right, Adam?
I famously do not like The Evens.
Yeah, well, I think they're pretty good. I do agree that it wouldn't hurt The Evens to, you know, up the ante and give it a little more power. And if there's a guy that can do it, it's Joe Lally, that's for sure. And so the question is, will they do... let's face it, everybody's hoping that they're basically... Not that they'll cover Fugazi, but they'll make Fugazi-type music. Or even if you're really into it, they'll make Minor Threat-type music. They're not going to make Minor Threat-type music, you know. I think what everyone's fearing is, are they just going to do kind of coffee shop acoustic stuff? And of course, Joe Lally's in Mystetics, and it's kind of like jazzy coffee shop kind of stuff. But I think everyone's hoping they come back, you know, with Fugazi, you know, basically punk or post-punk, heavy, loud, fast, powerful stuff. And maybe they will. It'd be really cool if they did. There always is the question is, well, if 50% of Fugazi can get together, why can't 100%, you know? Adam, I just had a thought. This is crazy. Could this be a cloak for an actual Fugazi reunion at the show?
No, I say no just because like cloak means you're trying to have a little stunt. Stunt means you appreciate a little bit of whimsy. I don't think Ian's not a whimsy guy to me.
Everyone's hoping this sounds exactly like Fugazi. Let's be real. It probably won't. It will probably be sort of like Fugazi, but not quite as punchy. I'm hoping it is super loud and crazy, and even when it's not, it could still be good, because I did like The Evens. What I thought was very interesting about this, Adam, is it's a benefit through a church, which I thought was very fascinating for many reasons. First of all, in punk rock, basically, the church is bad. We hate religion, you know. And also, of course, Ian MacKaye has, you know, the song Filler. But however, I think in elementary school or middle school, he actually went to a religious school, but it wasn't like a Catholic school. It was kind of like a more open-minded religious school. And I gotta say, I actually think it's kind of cool that Ian's doing it through a church, just because it's kind of unexpected. And he's sort of making the argument that not everything to do with religion is bad, which I think maybe punk is a little bit more of. You know what I mean? I think sometimes punk automatically says everything in this column is good and everything in that column is bad. And I think it's interesting that Ian is making this decision.
Yeah, I mean, it may just be that's the avenue that happens to be.
There's lots of homeless organizations, especially in D.C. There's probably hundreds, if not hundreds, then definitely dozens.
I don't know, John.
There's also the Punk News Cassette Fund, which he could have done a benefit for, you know.
Should I go re-listen to The Evens?
Yeah, you should. You should listen to the one, I think it's the second album. It's the one where, like, he sings about the president or whatever. You should. Adam, you should do it. I'm trying to think of it. You should do it when you're driving back from a concert. It was a good concert. You've got a long drive. You're a little tired, but you're not that tired, so you're drinking some iced tea to stay awake. Listen to the second Evens album.
All right, I will give the Evens another chance, because I wrote the Evens off at a point in my life where
you went with Rancid 5?
Well, yeah, basically, we're probably maybe. I mean, what year did that come out?
2002? No,
was it
Rancid
2000?
2000. Even just 2006.
Yeah, it is 2000. Everyone called that record Rancid 2000. I don't know why that was a stupid question. There was a point where I was in university, and the idea of hearing anyone play any more coffee shop acoustic political music made me want to go jump in the river. So I think I lumped it in with my reaction to that. So yeah, I will go listen to the Deviants once again.
To me, it always kind of like Gang of Four, to tell you the truth. Like, maybe not quite as heavy Gang of Four.
Now, here we go. Here we go. We can do this again. Speaking of old people, John, do the story. What's going on here?
Speaking of old people. And we can do it for after this one, too. But speaking of old people, this show already happened like 3 weeks ago by the time you heard this, or maybe even four. But there was a show in Stockholm, Sweden, run by a collective called Instapunk. What Instapunk is it's three or four or five Swedish punk bands, and they're all older punks. And in order to get into this show, there was an age minimum in that you have to be at least 40 or older to get into the show. But if you're under 40, there is hope. You can come in with a chaperone that is 40 or older. And the concert was called, the band's playing was The Old, The Bitter, and Pud Alone. And it was called Skala T. Tiern, which I don't know. That means something in Swedish, I guess. Anyways, I think this is hilarious. And I think most people thought this was hilarious. But a few people, I mean, Adam, I think you have to agree that this is purely done for amusement. And there's no, oh, and also they released this statement with the show. We are the angry voice of a middle-aged generation. We are 90-second songs. We are bored by youth. We wear our reading glasses with pride. We are the future, which I think is the funniest line in the whole thing. I think you have to read this as a total goof. It's just kind of funny and an amusing thing to do. And it's hilarious, although maybe it's making the argument that it's making the argument on one hand that old dudes can do punk rock and that punk rock isn't limited to age. But it's also making the counter-argument that if you're an old guy doing punk rock, it's a ridiculous thing to do and is silly and completely pointless, so let's do it anyways. So I think this is hilarious. I did find it interesting how some people really did take this seriously, and they're like, age limits are where everything that punk is against. You know what I mean? And this is just hilarious, you know?
Yeah, this did not seem like something to be angry about. It's pretty funny that that's actually going to... That you know, they actually went and put that together in that way. The only thing is that, like, are young people into punk at this point anyways? Like, should they not really have done this for, you know, let's say 50 plus? Because I feel that, you know, a lot of these bands that we're listening to, they're pushing 40 or past. Anyways.
Honestly, Adam, I will say actually punk is pretty thriving within the younger scene, you know, because I live outside Philadelphia. And so I guess pleasingly, past few months I've been gone to a lot more underground, well, not super underground, but underground punk shows, and there are a lot of younger people there. I would say the shows with the college students, though, it is punk, but it's not punk like Rancid, you know, it's more like kind of halfway between punk and indie rock, almost like grunge, to tell you the truth. You know what I mean? So it's not four guys in leather jackets and studs screaming I hate the government. It's really more two guys and two girls, or three girls, or two guys and two girls making loud, noisy rock, loud, noisy alt rock. And I would definitely say that counts as punk, and I would say that's the face of modern punk right now. And it's not this insta-punk kind of thing, and which they acknowledge, and which makes it funny.
Well, anyways, I thought this was a delightful story, so I don't know why anyone would be mad about it. So, here we go. Yeah, speaking of old people, so the Buzzcocks are going to reissue their first two records. So that would be Another Music in a Different Kitchen and Love Bites. The releases are coming out on January 25th of 2019 on Domino. And they state that the recordings have been remastered from the original quarter-inch tapes for the first time since their 1978 release. The booklets that are going to be with these records are going to feature new essays by John Savage and previously unseen photos, so that they're getting kind of like nice big reissues of those first couple Buzzcocks records. Here is my question for you, John.
Okay.
Here. Do any of the Buzzcocks studio albums matter at all?
Oh, I see. Singles Going Steady is more important, you're saying?
Because Singles Going Steady, in my humble opinion, despite the fact that it is a compilation, is one of, like, should be considered one of the foundational punk rock documents. Like, if I had to go give people five punk records to go really grasp what the genre was about, at least like what the late 70s version of the genre was about.
Four copies of Rancid, you know, 5 and Buzzcocks Singles Going Steady.
Right? Like, you know, I'd give them something like, I don't know, like Rocket to Russia, London Calling, Nevermind the Bullocks, and definitely Singles Going Steady, and then, I don't know, something else, right? But like to me, like, that is such a... Like, it's so, it has everything that matters about the Buzzcocks on it to me. So I don't know. I mean, to the point where I don't know if I have ever, in any serious, way, dug into any of the early Buzzcocks records myself. And I say that as, like, I consider myself a big fan of them, but I think that's more like I'm a big fan of Singles Going Steady than anything else. Am I wrong?
Yes.
Is there great stuff on...
I respect your opinion. Singles Going Steady is a great record. What the first two records for me are interesting is actually some of the songs are actually very unlike. See, Singles Going Steady is like Ramones 1, and then every song is you know, a 90-second, more like 120-second for Buzzcocks. 120-second banger, 120-second banger, 120-second banger, and they're all like pop, 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 pop. On the albums, they actually kind of purposely kind of had a few more stranger and weirder songs, but also there's the Spiral Scratch each EP, and I'm going to sound like a total dick when I say this, but Spiral Scratch is my favorite release, and my favorite Buzzcocks album is the album that has Howard Devoto singing vocals instead of the other two guys, because I'm a huge Magazine fan. So... Of course, if you have to pick one Buzzcock record, certainly it's Singles Going Steady. That being said, the two albums do have stuff on there that is beyond Singles Going Steady, purposefully so. I mean, it's a purposeful differentiation so that it's not in competition with Singles Going Steady. It's really more different than Singles Going Steady to a degree. My question, I think, when is too many reissues too many? You know, I mean, this album was just reissued like 2 or 3 years ago. One of the commenters brought up a good point. Is like, well, it is a reissue, but it's really just a redistribution in that, you know, these bands that have been around a long time, someone comes along and say, hey, we want to do an edition of your record. We want to do 5,000 copies. And the band's like, sure, give us, you know, $5 a record, $3 a record, and you can do it, you know. So, I would say these reissues are not an event like maybe some of the Ramones reissues are. And it's really just someone that's into the band or a label that's into the band wanting to have a piece of that band on for themselves, I guess, if you will.
It's a little bit like a damned if you do, damned if you don't thing, right?
Yeah.
Because so today, realistically, you're right. It is a label is going to go make 5,000 of these and put them out into the world. And that'll probably be like the start and end of it. And they're not picking up a perpetual license for any of these records at that point. It's a limited thing. But the label, of course, has their own self-interest of making sure that people actually want to buy the record that they're putting out. So they're not going to put out the record and then just be like, you know, hey, we know people are going to want to buy these. So we happen to be the people that's putting them in the stores. So the real news is that, you know, yes, you can still buy copies of Love Bites new, and they happen to be through us, right? Like, you know, if you're the marketing guy for Domino, you would be fired at that point. So you have to say it's a reissue and make it sound cool, and, you know, get someone to write an essay, like do something that's going to make it you know, an appealing product for people that potentially already have that record. So, like, I get that, because if I was in that situation, I would do the same thing, right? If, you know, or John, like, if Narmer Records all of a sudden got the rights to put out, you know, a bunch of copies of, like, let's see, like, even get off Buzzcocks here, right? Like, if all of a sudden you got the license to put out 5,000 copies of Leave Home, right? You would just be like, well, you know, you can always buy them. You can still buy them. They happen to have the Narmer Records logo on it. No, you'd make a giant deal about that.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that's just the way it works. So what are you going to do? I guess you can't really make a big deal about it again if you're to come back to our perpetual punching bag. Like, if you're just going to put out, like, another 30,000 copies of Tusk, I don't know if you can be like, finally, we're reissuing Tusk.
I'm trying to think what you would do to make it like special. You know, you'd be like,
it's just like dusted with cocaine,
pre-sniffed.
The only thing. Oh God, so many people I know were at Fleetwood Mac recently.
It's so weird. Like, for a while, like, all the young people were like, oh, Fleetwood Mac is so great. And I'm like, what? I'll never forget, Adam. I went down to Washington, D.C. to visit a girl once, and her friend was there, and her friend's boyfriend was there. And her friend was nice. Her friend's boyfriend, I hate to call someone a hipster, but this dude was, like, the most hipster of guy of all time. He's like, oh, yeah, man, we just saw Fleetwood Mac. It was amazing. And I'm like, Fleetwood Mac? And he's like, oh, it was so good, man. Dreams. And I mean, honestly, I actually like a lot of Stevie Nicks songs. But it's like, still, have some self-respect. Fleetwood Mac? I mean, really. Aubin Paul said it best, is people are revolting against their parents by listening to music even more bland than their parents listen to. Which is true.
Oh, Fleetwood Mac. What are you going to do? John, play a song and we'll roll on here.
Well, speaking of young people, I'm going to play a song by young people that we're going to talk about when we come back. This is the Amol and the Sniffers doing Some Mutts. I'll say it because they're Australian, so I'll say it like I'm Australian. Some Mutts can't be muzzled. That wasn't Australian at all.
That was kind of Cockney. Liverpool Neil. Is John? No. Do your song.
You got a new dog, do you remember me?
All right, we're back. Let's talk about that band here. So, Amyl and the Sniffers?
I think it's like Amyl Nitrate, so Amyl and the Sniffers.
Amyl and the Sniffers? So, all right. So, they have a new single that's out. We just listened to it. It's called Some Mutts Can't Be Muzzled. Why this band? Everyone's heard it. Rarely someone has just heard the music we're about to talk about.
True.
So, yeah.
Well, I think this is going to be my biggest – I think this will be one of my biggest show regrets of 2018. Long story short is I was supposed to have a hearing in Jersey City, and the afternoon beforehand – I'm trying to think how I can make this short and not bland. Basically, I had to stay up all night. I was crazed. I drove to Jersey City at like 3 a.m. and I really wanted to go see this band, but they were doing like a show in a record store at like 5 p.m. instead of like 9 p.m., which was bizarre. So by the time I got to Philadelphia, I was too tired, and so I decided to go home when really I could have went to this show because it was early and then gone home and went to sleep, which was so dumb of me, but I was so crazed and tired I didn't even think of it. Anyways, this band is getting a lot of hype. I had heard of them, but I didn't go to the show. If I had listened to them before, like that day, I would have toughed it out because, at least in the Philly punk scene, this is one of these bands that is like really getting a lot of hype and be like, oh, like this is the band. Like if you're into punk, like real underground, well, not real. If you're into like the real punk scene, not like the mainstream punk scene, but the real punk scene, this is the band people are talking about. The criticism is that it's a little retro sounding, which. I might concede that's a little true, and just as I said, I'm kind of bored right now of like vibrators type punk or whatever. This does sound like it could have been recorded in 1979, 1980. That being said, it is fantastic, and what I really like is, they're Australian, so they sound really cool. The songs are amazingly written. The songs are great. But the lyricist, her name is Amy. She's the singer. She writes lyrics in a way that you very rarely see in modern punk rock. You might see this in, like, you know, from the Avengers in 1978, or maybe like, X-Ray Specs, or maybe even like the Slits. A perspective that you don't often see in modern punk. And I'm just going to read one of the lyrics here that. At first, it comes off and it's sung as a very simple lyric, but when you really think about it, it's actually like a very complex thing that really makes you think about what's going on in this song and what's the story that this song is telling. Adam, I'm going to read you these lyrics. You've got a new dog, do you remember me? She walks around on my old leash. You've got a new dog, do you remember me? Am I just a memory? You've got a new dog, do you remember me? Is she just as good as me? Some mutts just can't be muzzled. Well, I guess I got you puzzled, woof woof. So I really like how the leash, well, I guess there's reference to the Stooges to begin with, you know, but she's saying that I used to be on your leash, you know, which means she used to be kind of, I guess, submissive or bossed around by the guy. But on the other hand, she's like, you like the new girl because you can muzzle her, but you can't muzzle me, which I think there's a whole lot of interesting lyrical things going on there that you can really think about and try to determine what's going on. And I think it's a very human expression, whereas right now in punk right now, there's a lot of, you know, moralizing it and scripture, if you will, like this is punk and that's, you know, if you do this, you're good. If you do that, then you're bad. And to a degree, there are benefits to that. And there, I mean, Crass did just that. I mean, there's almost no humanism in Crass, you know, Crass is strictly tracked. But I also do like how this type of lyric says, it's a very human lyric that I think comes closer to how people really are than maybe the idealized version of what a punk or a person is. And that's what I really like about this track. And it's banging to Adam. It rocks.
Well, the listeners have heard it now, so they can they can judge for themselves. Weird fact, like up until, you know, probably like literally a year ago, I thought that amyl nitrates were anal nitrates, and I just assumed that was what the phrase was, but that's not what it is. So there you go. Don't put it in your butt.
Did you like the song, Adam?
Yeah, I did. It's cool. I'm down with it. I'm down.
I mean, honestly, like, for some reason, we don't hear that much Australian music in the States. I love the Australian accent, and I loved how the singer, I love her specific dialect, if you will. You know what I mean? Like, it's a very, it actually, she sounds almost exactly like Courtney Barnett. So I bet she comes from the same area as Courtney Barnett. Melbourne. Let's see where Courtney Barnett's from. I just love how the voice sounds.
If you're wrong here, you have no recourse.
Yeah, if I'm wrong, it might be even racist because, like, trying to race against Australians because you think they all sound the same. It's like, Australia's not a race. Doesn't matter, John, you're racist. Bam! Born in Melbourne, Courtney Barnett. Bam! Damn, I'm good.
Yeah, all right.
So I'm not racist. Or am I racist because I can identify certain attributes to a class of people? I've got a lot to think about.
You may just be lucky in that you listed one of the internationally known cities from Australia. Are we doing this next story? Or are we skipping it? Because
let me take a look. We're running late here. Let's skip it. Maybe we'll do it next time. You know, whatever. I do want to talk about Hardy Fox though, real quick at least.
Yeah, we have two in memoriams that we want to make mention of before we close off the program here. So do the first one.
Okay. Unfortunately, Hardy Fox, who was associated with the Residents, passed away. If the listeners don't know, the Residents were a band that kind of started right around when punk started. But I mean, you definitely can make the argument that they are a punk band, but more so, I kind of think they're a post-hippie band or just a weird, weird band. They literally have over 100 records, and their records are probably some of the most unusual, weirdest music there ever is. It's not noise, like, there's noise music, which is weird, but it's not, it's music, but it's so weird, and sometimes it's extremely challenging, sometimes it's not. You've probably seen their iconic look. It's guys in tuxedos with giant eyeball heads, if you will. Adam, are you familiar with the Residents? Adam, you there?
More visually than their material. I mean, there's so much of it that just, you know, not something I've dug into.
So anyway, the Residents are, there's a couple of greatest hits albums, but even that, like, really won't give you an idea of what they do. And honestly, Residents are a band I'm still working on becoming a fan of. I know some really weird dudes that, like, the Residents is their band. There's lots of fun things about the Residents. One of the fun things about them is no one knows who the Residents are. They have some people that have spoken for them, but each of those people have said, oh, we're not in the Residents. We just know them, or we act as their spokesperson, but we're not in them. There's Homer Flynn, which is not his real name, Jay Clem, and John Kennedy, and that's not one of their real names. Another guy, Hardy Fox, and he was actually their usual spokesperson for 30 or 40 years. A lot of people think Hardy Fox actually was one of the four residents with Homer Flynn, Jay Clem, and John Kennedy. No one knows, and it could be that the actual musicians have changed a lot, but it's directed by these four guys, or maybe there really is secret guys behind the Residents, and, you know, Hardy Fox and the other guys kind of just help out. The reality, and no one knows for sure, the reality is Hardy Fox, Homer Flynn, Jay Clem, and John Kennedy were probably the guys that wrote the music and performed a lot as the Residents, but we'll probably never know for sure. And these guys, I mean, they are weird. We talk about a lot of weird music on punk news. Like, I don't know. What's weird that we talk about on punk news, Adam? Trying to think of, like what's a weird band that we often talk about? Like, Effed Up is weird, but compared to the Residents, Effed Up is not weird. And with the Residents, it's like compound concept on top of compound concept on top of compound. Like, the concept of Effed Up's new record is that someone, you know, is going through a void and they're looking back on their life and the decisions they could have made. That's the concept of Effed Up's new record. The Residents, who knows what the concept is most of the time? Like, it is, like, so far out and weird. I guess surrealist is the buzzword, but whoever really knows. I emailed Hardy Fox one time when the Residents were doing something, and I got a response back, and that was, like, a real thrill. It's like, wow, Hardy Fox emailed me back, and it was as weird as you'd expect it to be. And extremely talented person, and it's sad that he passed away. I know, I'm not going to name him, but I know a punk rocker that we have spoken about on the podcast before. He's not someone that we regularly talk about. So we talked about the Dwarves a lot, or Keith Moore. It's not one of those guys, but it's a guy we've mentioned a couple of times. He knows who the Residents are, and of course he won't tell anybody. And I think he's associated with them somehow, but he won't say how he's associated with, which I think is really cool. I know another guy who's not associated with the Residents, but he thinks he knows who the Residents are, but he doesn't want to look into it because he doesn't want to shatter the mystery. And so Adam, the Residents have this giant complex thing that they are, you know? is it interesting that they pass away and never reveal the mystery, or should they reveal the mystery at the end of the project, if you will?
Oh, no, no, they have to leave it. I mean, I think it's entirely a worthy endeavor for someone to, you know, to write the encyclopedia afterwards, where they go and they delve into the history and sort out all the facts. But no, no, they shouldn't pull back the veil at this point.
Anyway, Residential, I mean, honestly, it is not easy listening. R.I.P. Hardy Fox, it's sad that he passed away, but as far as bodies of work go and interesting music and daring music, he's at the top, or nearly at the top. I mean, like, I'm working on the Residents myself. I can't even tell you where to start. It's so massive and so weird. Maybe Meet the Residents, which is the first album, but, you know, what a group. I mean, what a mountain of work. I mean, really.
Yeah, so that's the first of our two obits that we want to share on this podcast. The second was that Todd Youth had passed away. This would have been during the last week of October. He was 47 when he died. Now, Todd was a veteran punk and metal musician, and he played with, like, everyone. He played and recorded with Murphy's Law, Warzone, Danzig, Blood Clot, Degeneration, Fireburn, and many, many more. He was a standing guitarist for a few Motorhead dates. He served as a studio musician with Glenn Campbell. One of our commenters on Punk News is mentioning that, like, they went and they saw Ace Frehley once, and Todd was playing with them. So at the point when our article went up, the cause of death was unknown. But if you go look up his story on Punk News, this is a nice selection of tracks that he was a part of that you can go check out that are on there. So Todd would have been a part of probably a whole bunch of the Misfits Week stuff too, given all the Danzig.
He's on a lot of the later day Danzig stuff, and then he was also with Blood Clot with John Joseph. He was kind of the guy that established musicians would bring in to, like, really give them some real oomph and power and credibility, because everybody respects Todd Youth. He's great at what he does. He actually got involved in punk rock. We were early on with Murphy's Law and Warzone and that kind of a thing. Actually, Warzone's before Murphy's Law for him, I think. And so he's got his bona fide, and he's just, I mean, he was the guy to bring, like if you're a singer and you kind of need to rejuvenate your career or come back with a record that doesn't suck and is really good, Todd Youth was the guy to call, and he delivered many times, you know, Danzig's later day records, Blood Clot was a great record, and even Glenn Campbell, that record is great, or at least those songs. So it's, that's who we, certainly talented guitarist, and who passed way too soon, what can I say, you know?
I mean, like, if you want to look at, like, the gigantic list of bands that you know he had something to do with, he played on a recent Cheap Trick record. Like, he's just all over the place. So I'm nothing really to add to that. So, John, are we playing something by one of these gentlemen to
let's
roll it out here?
You know what? I think he was really thrilled to play with Glenn Campbell. Let's do his work with Glenn Campbell. I never interviewed Todd Youth. I didn't know him, but I think that's something that he was, like, really throwing the deal, because that was, like, something, like, that he respected, and it's kind of an unusual thing for him. So everyone will probably play stuff with Danzig or Blood Clot or Murphy's Law or Warzone, but let's do Todd Youth with Glenn Campbell because it's a neat and interesting recording. It just goes to show the variety and intonation and emotion that he was able to put into his guitar. So this is Glenn Campbell with Todd Youth doing one of Glenn Campbell's final recordings.
Drives away.
right, we're back. If anyone wants to send us email, it is podcast@punknews.org. That is how you do that. Anything else, John? Anything we need to tell the people?
What bands
send
you
money.
Want? Give us money. What bands would you like to hear on the podcast? I mean, Band Week next year. And I got to say, Adam, I'm already thinking about Summer Soiree 3 in my brain. I've got ideas. Oh, actually, I'm not going to announce it, but I threw an idea past Adam, and Adam did not like it, which makes me want to double down on it even more. So we'll see. We'll see.
No, it is such people. It is the wrong idea. Wrong.